The gospel writers, in essence, focused on, what do we got? You need the mic up. Oh, John's giving me signals back there. Panic. All right. We're better? Good. You keep me straight, John. The gospel writers basically focused on three aspects of the New Testament Passover. When they wrote about the Passover, the last Passover that Jesus kept in the flesh. If we go back to Exodus chapter 12, I want to start there just to read a couple of things about the Old Testament Passover. And we'll only read a couple of the verses here. Verse 5, leading up to this, talks about the 10th day of the month, he set aside a lamb. And verse 5 specifically says, your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. We'll skip down a couple of verses and pick it up again in verse 8. It says, then they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire, with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs they shall eat it. Do not eat it raw, nor boiled at all with water, but roasted in fire. Its head, its legs, and its entrails. Now that sounds kind of gross to us. I've read many other translations that say heart, liver, you know, internal organs kind of a thing. So I'm not quite, we read this and I think, oh, you know, yuck. But we're not exactly sure specifically how it was prepared, but it made sense to them. I'll just say it that way. It could have been that it was the internal organs that they wanted, that God wanted roasted in there as well. But anyway, there were several points about this. The Old Testament Passover had a lamb, had bitter herbs. The lamb could be from the sheep or the goats, had to be a yearling without blemish. There were very specific things that God was asking of ancient Israel when they kept the Passover. Had to be roasted on a fire, not raw, not boiled in water, and they were to eat it with unleavened bread. Now, in the New Testament, Christ instituted the symbols of eating a little bit of unleavened bread, and he specifically tied the unleavened bread to his broken body. As you've kept Passover or heard of this many years, you're very familiar with it, that, and he emphasized drinking a little bit of wine, which he associated with his shed blood. It is those two aspects that he emphasized specifically in the New Testament, the little bit of unleavened bread, a little bit of wine. Now, we're not told in the Old Testament whether it specifically included drinking wine. Would not have been uncommon at all. Wine was very common to drink in the Old Testament, especially with some special meal. So I would not be surprised at all if it was included in the Old Testament. But he specifically in the New Testament said, this bread pictures my broken body, and this wine pictures my shed blood, which we understand to be the symbols of the New Testament Passover. But he also added one other thing that the gospel writers focus on, and in reality, it's only one gospel writer who gives us this information. It's in John chapter 13. The other gospel writers don't mention it, but John does in detail. And John, as we understand, was probably the last gospel written. And John seems to have taken a little different perspective than the other gospel writers did. He wrote some things that the others didn't and emphasized some things that the others didn't. And he, we find, is the one who emphasizes this particular event or this particular aspect on the Passover. Chapter 13 of John, verse 1. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Now, as I think about the meaning of that, there's quite a bit of meaning in that one verse alone, isn't it? From the very beginning, Jesus Christ had this in mind. It was the plan of the Father and Jesus Christ, a joint plan, that was going to offer salvation to mankind. And he talks about his love for mankind, even up to the end of his physical life. But let's go on, verse 2. It says, and supper being ended, or toward the end of supper, the devil having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Now, we usually read through this passage on the night of Passover and remind ourselves of that event. So I won't read through the whole passage. I won't read it all. today. But we probably remember, you probably remember, that Peter was indignant, or we could say incredulous. Somehow he was very surprised that Jesus was going to wash his feet and said, "No, you'll never do that." And Jesus said, "If I don't do it, you don't have any part in me." And then Peter jumps in the other ditch. "Well, all right, if my feet, then wash my head, and my, you know, wash my whole body." And Jesus had to steer him back toward the middle of the road and said, "You don't need all of that. You just need me to wash your feet. You don't understand it now, but you will later." Now, the interesting thing about this is if we go to Luke's account, turn with me to Luke chapter 22. In Luke chapter 22, we find that Luke gives us some insight that John doesn't. We've often heard, I've often said, that the Bible is a book of addition, not subtraction. You add things. When it comes to the gospel accounts, you don't take one thing in one gospel account and say, "Okay, if the other gospel accounts don't corroborate this, I throw it out." We subtract it from the Bible. You take the different perspectives of the individuals and you add them. You put them together to get the full picture. Now, John doesn't say anything about this particular event, but Luke does in Luke chapter 22. Let's turn Luke 22 and verse 24. Luke 22 and verse 24. Actually, we could back up a couple of verses in verse 23. It says, "Then they began to question among themselves which of them it would be that would do this thing." When he talked about being betrayed, this was during the Passover. And verse 24 says, "Now there was also a dispute among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. And he said to them, 'The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors, but not so among you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he who governs as he who serves. For who is greater, he that sits at the table or he who serves? Is it not he who sits at the table? Yet I am among you as the one who serves.'" This was taking place on Passover night. Back up a few verses, back to verse 15, and he's talking to them with a fervent desire. "I've desired to eat this Passover with you." And on Passover night, they're arguing about who's the greatest. Now, Luke adds that, as I say, John doesn't mention it, but Jesus' comments about being a servant in response to their argument about who was the greatest among them adds a little bit to the meaning of that foot washing ceremony, doesn't it? When you realize that it's in the context of their argument over who's the greatest. Even though we don't know the exact time sequence, it's very apropos for Jesus Christ to have said then what he did about foot washing and what he said about serving in terms in opposition to lording it over people. Now, if this discussion, or if the foot washing was before their argument about who's the greatest, then it's a testimony to their lack of understanding, isn't it? He just told you to act like a servant. Even if you're in a position of authority, you treat people as though you're serving them. If it was after it, it just went right over their head. Now, if he said this, if the foot washing came after that argument, you know, the foot washing was before it and they had this argument afterward, they just missed the whole point of it. But if the foot washing came after their argument, it makes it even more meaningful, doesn't it? Because he showed them. He showed them what they needed to do. International Standard Bible Encyclopedia says most scholars believe the foot washing came after the argument, after Luke recorded this bickering about who's going to be the greatest. Now, like I said, we don't know exactly which it was, but this last night of Christ's life in the flesh teaches us a lot about Christianity, teaches us a lot about what we should be doing as Christians, how we should be living, gives us a lot of insight. What I'd like to do today is focus on this topic of foot washing. I was telling somebody last night at the campout, I started looking back, when did I last talk about foot washing? I can't remember having done that in a long, long time. So thought that's probably appropriate something to do. What do we learn from this act of foot washing? What does it teach us? Now, most of you would probably come up with the same two main points that I have and that I'll talk about today. It's, in that sense, not a mystery. One of the first ones that comes to my mind is the point of humility. And this is very definitely an issue of humility. When you're willing to wash someone else's feet, there's a level of humility that's expressed by that. And Jesus Christ was expressing that as well. Here Luke tells us Jesus emphasized that point of being like a servant, being willing to serve, being willing to help, being willing to step in and do a menial job. You humble yourself to do that. Their pride apparently wouldn't let them do that. Jesus said, as a Christian, you don't act like the great high muckety-muck or whatever other term you want to use. You humble yourself. And of course, service is closely tied to that. The two points that come to my mind very quickly and probably did to yours as well. Let's talk about service, first of all. Service is, foot washing is very obviously an act of service. It's serving people. It's doing something for them, helping them. Let's look at a few verses on this. I'd like to turn to Luke chapter 7. In Luke chapter 7, we actually look at a different event, but this event gives us a little bit of insight into the thinking in the first century, what everyday common life was like in the first century, and talks about service in some aspects of life. Luke chapter 7, down in verse 36, we can pick it up there. One of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him, and he went to the Pharisee's house and sat down to eat. And behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at the table of in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil and stood at his feet behind him weeping. And she began to wash his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. And she kissed his feet and anointed them with the fragrant oil. And the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, and he spoke to himself, saying, "This man, if he were a prophet, would know who and what manner of woman this is that's touching him, for she's a sinner." How can he let her touch him even, have anything to do with him? Now, I'll skip the lesson that he teaches, but let's jump down to verse 44, where after he had addressed a certain aspect of this about being forgiven and debtors being forgiven more or less, in verse 44, then he turned to the woman and said to Simon was the Pharisee who had invited him to dinner. He addressed Simon. He said, "Do you see this woman? I entered your house and you gave me no water for my feet, but she's washed my feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. You gave me no kiss, but this woman has not ceased to kiss my feet since the time I came in. You didn't anoint my head with oil, but this woman has anointed my feet with fragrant oil." Now, this gives us a little bit of an idea of the customs of the day. A typical thing that would happen when someone entered someone else's house is that, first of all, you would be offered a chance to wash your feet, to have them cleansed from the dirty roads that you've been walking on. When a guest entered the house of a wealthy person, a servant typically was the one who would do that. He would wash the feet of the guests. And that was considered a menial job. It was considered a job for someone who wasn't in a high position. It was considered a menial thing. And they would wash, it was their job to wash their feet. An interesting note back in the Old Testament on this, I'm going to leave something here, I'll be back to this in a minute. But let's go back to 1 Samuel chapter 25. Many centuries prior to this, in 1 Samuel chapter 25, we have the story of Abigail. And I won't read the whole story, but her husband, Nabal, was pretty ugly in his response to David's request for some food for his men. And if you remember the story, Abigail interceded and kept David from killing Nabal and his whole family, killing all of the men. In verse 40, let's pick it up there. This is sort of after the story. after Nabal then had died on his own, that David sent to Abigail. In verse 40, it says, when the servants of David had come to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke to her, saying, David sent us to you to ask you to become his wife. And she arose, bowed her face to the earth, and said, here is your maidservant, a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord. A servant to wash even the servants' feet. I'm the lowliest of the low. Why is he asking me to marry him? I don't deserve that. She had the attitude of, I'm nobody. I'm nobody. My position would be to wash the servants' feet, not even the guests' feet. It's interesting to see this attitude, even in the Old Testament, of being willing to serve in such a low state or an easy or a low way. Nabal, of course, had treated David and his men very evilly, but David and God had killed him. But again, Abigail's attitude in this, I should just be washing the feet of the servants. Back in Luke chapter 7, that was one of the things that Jesus said, you didn't give me even any water for my feet. Now, if there weren't servants in the home, if someone was not that well off, well, at least you would give water and let the person wash their own feet. And he said, you didn't even do that. You didn't even give me water that I could wash my own feet. And he says, you didn't give me a kiss in verse 45. The Pharisee ignored the common courtesy of a common greeting. Typically in that day, it was a kiss. Today, we would hug. We would at least shake hands. We would give some kind of a greeting. And he said, you didn't even give me the common courtesy of a greeting when I entered your home. You didn't give me any oil to anoint my head. Guests were typically given that to freshen up a little bit. So at the last Passover service of his human life, Jesus instituted foot washing. He did not institute the other common acts of greeting of his day. He didn't say, you know, you have to kiss, you have to give people oil for their head. But he did do the foot washing, a common greeting of the day, and something that was often considered a menial job. We see in John 13 that this is commanded by Jesus. Let's go back to John's account. John 13, when he talked about the foot washing, he doesn't mention, and some of those other greetings could have taken place that evening. I'm not saying they didn't. They may have been the common courtesies of the day, and they may have been followed as well. But the point here is John doesn't emphasize that. God didn't emphasize that. But Jesus did emphasize the foot washing. In verse 14, if we pick it up in John 13, he says, if I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done. I've set an example for you. And you should do the same thing. You ought to follow my example. That's specifically in terms of the foot washing. Now, as an aside, let me give you some reasons the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia says that we maybe don't have to do this today. I found their article rather interesting on this particular topic. They began by discussing the verb tense of this, that you should do this to one another. Happy are you, as he says later on in verse 17, blessed are you if you do these things. They talked about the verb tense and they said, you know, the verb tense really implies that this should be forever. This should be on and on and on in perpetuity. That it ought to continue to be done right on down through history. And then they start saying, but you know, in the fourth century, it became common practice that the Pope would pick 12 poor people and 12 poor men, and he would wash their feet on Maundy Thursday. And since it was never mentioned or commanded by any of the other gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, or Luke didn't mention it, therefore maybe it doesn't have to be in perpetuity. Maybe we can let the Pope do it for everybody. They also said, well, no large body of Christians has ever received this as a sacrament ordinance. They've never adopted it as a practice. No big group has ever done this. So those are their reasons for not doing it. I'll let you reason through in your own mind whether those objections should negate Christ's clear statement, I've done this, you should do this to one another, because I've set you an example. I think their arguments are pretty hollow and empty, in my estimation. Practice was clearly an outreach of an act of service. It was a service to the other disciples, and when we put together Luke's statement about their argument about who's the greatest in Christ's teaching on that, it's very clear what Christ was pointing out, that you serve one another, you help one another. Humility is also a part of this. It's tied in with service. Let's take a look at this second aspect of humility. Again, let's go into the historical background. What if a poor person invited guests over? I alluded to this a while ago. What if it was a poor person that didn't have any servants? Well, at least the host would provide water and let people wash their own feet. At least they could have their feet cleaned. And what several sources say about this is what we learn from this is that the host never washed the feet of the guests. It wasn't the host. If you didn't have servants to do it, you didn't, as a host, do it. You let the guests do it themselves. Contrast that with what Christ is doing. Christ said, I'm the host. I'm the one hosting this Passover dinner. I've invited you to set up this Passover dinner. I've instructed you to set it up. I'm the host here. I'm not the guest. You're the guests. And as the host, I'm stooping down to wash your feet. What a powerful example. Again, a contrast of humility. What a contrast between Jesus Christ and the disciples who were worried about who was the greatest, who would have the highest position in the kingdom. They didn't stoop to wash anyone else's feet. They didn't even stoop to wash Jesus' feet. To do that would have been to admit they were below some of the others, and they were worried about who was greater than all the others. Great contrast. Their pride wouldn't let them do that. But here's one who truly was much greater than them, and he didn't mind washing their feet. It's a great act of humility on Christ's part. Let's go back to Luke's comments about their argument. Let's go back to Luke 22. Luke chapter 22. I read this a while ago, but let's pick it up again, or go through it again in verse 26. When he talked about Gentiles exercising lordship over people, in that sense, lording it over them, in verse 26 he says, but not so among you. On the contrary, in great contrast to the way Gentiles do things, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he who governs as he who serves. For who's greater? He that sits at the table or he who serves? Is it not he that sits at the table? And yet I am among you as the one who serves. I'm hosting this. I'm the one this Passover is all about. It's my body. It's my blood that's going to be shed for you. And yet I'm willing to stoop down and wash your feet. What an incredible passage that talks about humility. Now, some want to use this section and say, well, there's no authority in the church. He's getting rid of authority altogether. He's not doing that. Doesn't say that whatsoever. All he says is you have to serve. If you've been given a responsibility, if you have some authority, if you have some responsibility in the church, you use that authority in the way Jesus Christ used his authority. He used it in kindness, and he used it in humility. And used it in a way that served and helped other people. Can someone have a position of responsibility and still express humility and service? Jesus Christ obviously did. And it's what he expects of us as Christians, no matter what our responsibilities are. Even the act of coming as a human was an act of humility. Let me get my other book here now. I'd like to read, let's turn to Philippians chapter 2. I'd like to read this out of the Jewish New Testament. This is a translation by David Stern. But I'd like to read this out of the Jewish New Testament, Philippians chapter 2, verses 1 through 8. It points out the humility of Jesus Christ in coming in the flesh. He says, therefore, if you have any encouragement for me from your being in union with the Messiah, any comfort flowing from love, any fellowship with me in the Spirit, or any compassion and sympathy, then complete my joy by having a common purpose and a common love, by being one in heart and mind. Do nothing out of rivalry or vanity, but in humility regard each other as better than yourselves. Look out for each other's interest and not just for your own. Let your attitude toward one another be governed by your being in union with the Messiah, Jesus. Or the Jewish form would be Yeshua. Though he was in the form of God, he did not regard equality with God something to be possessed by force. On the contrary, he emptied himself in that he took the form of a slave by becoming like human beings are. And when he appeared as a human being, he humbled himself still more, being obedient, becoming obedient even to death. Death on a stake as a criminal. What an incredible expression of humility to come as a human being. And to come realizing that he was going to give his life. He was going to die for us. He humbled himself to die as a criminal for our benefit. He did it for you. He did it for me. Have you ever thought about or analyzed Christ last night from the perspective of those two points, humility and service? I thought it was rather interesting for me to analyze that last night from that perspective in the teaching that he had on that last night. I'd like to share that with you. If we'll go to John chapter 14, I'm not going to read through all of this, basically kind of give you an overview of it. But as I do this, keep in mind those two points, service and humility. Service and humility, that was what was on Jesus Christ's mind. We know it was on his mind because of the foot washing. We know it was on his mind because of what Luke says about their arguing about who was the greatest, who would have the highest position, the highest amount of authority. John chapter 14, this whole chapter is a part of the instruction that Jesus gave on that Passover night, that last Passover, that he kept in the flesh. And if you look at chapter 14, this whole discourse is not centered on himself. It's not centered on what he's going to go through. He doesn't give the details about how he's going to be betrayed, exactly how that's going to happen, how they're going to take him. He doesn't talk about being beaten. He doesn't talk about being abused. He doesn't talk about being mistreated by the soldiers. He doesn't talk about any of that. It's not about him. If you look at what he says in his teaching, in chapter 14, it's all about the disciples. He is other-oriented, not self-oriented. But he knew what he was going through, or going to go through. He knew what he was going to endure. But his focus was on others. His focus was on the disciples. He didn't want them to be troubled. Chapter 14, verse 1, let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions, many places of authority. If it weren't so, I'd tell you, I'm going to go, but I'm going to prepare a place for you. I'm not preparing it for me, I'm preparing it for you. And if I go, I'll come again and I'll receive you. His focus is on calming the disciples and on encouraging them that stay true, stay certain, stay on course, and your reward is sure. Your reward will come. It will be given. He tells them he'll do what they ask of him, and he'll send the Holy Spirit as a helper, so they won't be left as orphans. That's down in verses 14 through 26, through the good part of the chapter. If you ask anything in my name, I'll do it. I'll respond. I'll listen to you. I care about you. You're important to me. I'll send the Holy Spirit. Verse 16, I'll pray the Father. He'll send you another helper, that it may abide with you forever, the Spirit of truth. The focus of this chapter, again, as I say, is outgoing. It's the attitude of somebody who's a servant. It's the attitude of somebody who is filled with humility. I care about you, disciples. I care about what's going to happen to you. I care about your peace of mind. In fact, he talks about that in verse 27. Peace I leave you. My peace I leave you. Not as the world gives do I give. Lest your heart be troubled, neither let it be. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. He's focused on them. He's concerned about them. Chapters 15 and 16 are more of the same types of comments about encouragement. Abide in me and you'll be productive. You know, that's what staying in the vine is all about. Abide in me, you'll produce. You will produce. If you stick with me, if you stay attached with me, attached to me. Don't worry if the world hates you. Don't worry if you get persecuted by the world. I've endured that before you. I know what it's like. And I can be there beside you to help you. To help you endure whatever difficulties you go through. You'll have troubles. Yes, you will. But even though you'll have troubles, realize I'm there. And realize I'll be there on the other end of those troubles. Be of good cheer. I'm with you. I'll help you. I'll encourage you through the gift of the Holy Spirit. Chapter 15 and 16 focus on both chapters focus on that. Verse 22 of chapter 16, you have sorrow, but I'll see you again. Your heart will rejoice. No one will take that joy from you. And of course, after his resurrection, they did see him again, and they were incredibly encouraged. And they were given the heart to go and preach the gospel to the whole world, to the ends of the earth. Chapter 17 is his final prayer, and you might think, well, in the final prayer, it may be his focus on asking God to help him. It wasn't. His final prayer there with the disciples. It was recorded, so John apparently heard it. He lifted up his eyes. He spoke these words, lifted up his eyes, verse 1 of chapter 17 says, lifted up his eyes to heaven and said, Father, the hour has come. Apparently this was a verbal spoken prayer the disciples heard. And his focus, again, is on the disciples and those who would come after him, after them. Verses 18, 19. Mention that. Verse 17, sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I've also sent them into the world. And for their sakes, I sanctify myself, that they also may be sanctified by the truth. I don't pray for these alone, but also for those who will believe in me through their word. His mind at this time, knowing what he was going to suffer, knowing what he was going to endure, was on you and me. And everyone who comes after us, and everyone who's come before us, who have been Christians, who have been true servants of God. His focus, again, was on his disciples and those who would become disciples later. Now, after this, of course, we do know, John chapter 18 talks about him leaving, going over to the Mount of Olives, and the place where Judas betrayed him. And we know that he did pray there. I guess we shouldn't ignore that. Matthew chapter 26 does talk a little bit about his prayer. Matthew chapter 26. They sang a hymn, verse 30, went out to the Mount of Olives, and down in verse 36 of Matthew chapter 26, Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, sit here while I go and pray over there. And this was his private prayer. Not his prayer to the disciples or public prayer to the disciples. This was a private prayer. He took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed, and he said to them, my soul is extremely sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me. And he went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, oh, my Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. The important thing is not me, God. The important thing is you and your will, because your will involves many more sons being born into your family. That's much greater than my comfort at this time, Father. I sure don't want to go through it. And if there's any other way you can think of, now is the time. You know, we're down to the 11th hour and whatever it is, 59 minutes or seconds, and 59 minutes and 59 seconds. We're right there. I mean, this is it. If there's any other way, please do it. But if not, it's your will, not mine. That's the attitude of a servant. That's the attitude of someone with humility. Someone who's thinking of others and not just himself. I won't read through all of this prayer. Luke tells us that his prayer, Luke's account of it mentions that his prayer was so great, so deep, that it even looked like blood. Perhaps the capillaries breaking down and blood mixing with his sweat. This was an intense prayer to the Father because he knew what he was going to endure. But because of his attitude of service and humility, his foot-washing attitude, he was willing to do it, willing to receive and accept the Father's answer. He was humble enough, had enough of an attitude of service to do that. So, nothing striking today in that sense in this message. It's about service. It's about humility. It's what foot washing is all about. How do we do that? Well, obviously we wash feet at Passover service. But how do we do that through the rest of the year? I mean, these are characteristics we're supposed to display at Passover, but Christianity is not a one-day-a-year practice, is it? This is something we should be doing throughout the year. We should be displaying the same attitude of service and humility throughout the year, not just one evening. So how do we do it through the rest of the year? Well, I think of a number of ways. I've got a few thoughts I jotted down here. How do we do it in our families? There are lots of ways we do this. There are lots of ways we show this in our family, this attitude of service, this attitude of humility. Husbands should be willing to serve and help their wives. How well do we do that, husbands? How well do we show our wife that we're willing to serve her, that we're willing to help her? That while God has set an order of responsibility within the family, he's established that, but we're to serve. We're to serve the same way Jesus Christ did, and we're to use those positions of responsibility and authority as Jesus Christ did. Wives could willingly serve their husbands. Wives should do that. Parents should humbly serve and sacrifice for their children. I'll add sacrifice because service usually involves sacrifice, doesn't it? When we serve, it's not always the most convenient time to serve. There's usually some kind of sacrifice involved in it. If nothing else, sacrificing what you want to do at the moment for the benefit of others. Now, it doesn't mean children boss the parents around, and that's not what I'm talking about any more than the disciples bossed Jesus Christ around. They didn't. He still was their teacher. He had to teach them things. Parents still have to teach children. There is an order that God has established. But the point is, do we use those positions of responsibility, even that God has given us within family, as husbands, and then secondly as parents, do we use those in the way Jesus Christ used his position of authority? Expressing love, compassion, expressing this humility and this attitude of service. We do that as a church family too, don't we? We serve one another. We help one another. There are things that have to be done. People serve in the local congregation all the time. Do lots of things. Do you do it from that perspective? I guess that's the question we all have to ask ourselves. Why do I do it? Do I do it because I love helping other people? Or is there some other reason? Maybe I want to be seen. It could be all kinds of other reasons people might do it. But if we do it for the right reason, we're doing it with a foot-washing attitude. Attitude of service, an attitude of humility. Even the simple things like signing a card. You know, that is a great service to other people, to those who are ill or those who have been discouraged in various ways. Talk to anybody who has been seriously ill and receive cards. And they'll tell you how much it means to them. There's been a great example here, a long-standing practice of having a concern corner that was going before we got here. I have nothing to do with it in the sense of getting it started. It's been a practice of this congregation for years, and it's a wonderful service. wonderful service to do for those who are ill. It's extremely helpful. Those who get those cards or you sign each week are thrilled to see that expression of service and loving concern. It's come sometimes from all around the world. Mrs. McCready was telling me this morning that they've gotten emails and messages from all over the place. She said, I don't even know so many people. I said, it doesn't matter. You know, they know there's a time of need. And they're doing their part. And it means a lot to those. Intercessory prayer, it's another act of humble service. You know what that act of intercessory prayer does? It says, the needs of somebody else are as good as my needs, are better than my needs. I don't need to pray about myself right now. I need to pray about this person. They're having a more difficult time than I am. They're having a health difficulty. They're having a trial. They're having discouragement. They're going through this. They're going through that. And I'm willing to talk about them, Father. I want you to pay special attention to them. It's an act of service. It's an act of humility. Fellowshipping, talking with one another, asking about needs, asking about their lives, their troubles, hopes, dreams. Again, that's a service to other people. Because it's not focusing on self. Giving rides, donating above and beyond tithes and offerings for someone that has need. There are all kinds of ways that we do this as a church family. So we do it in our physical family. We do it in our church family. You know what? In one sense, we do it for all humanity too, don't we? We are to serve all humanity. If you think about it, the greatest service we can do is to share the truth of God with the world. First of all, through our example, the way we live, the way we treat our neighbors, the way we treat our coworkers, the way we treat everyone we come in contact with. And of course, we have the formal method as well of literature and trying to preach the gospel. We have our first booklet that just this week we finalized the layout and the cover. I'm kind of excited about it. It's a little different format than we've used before. Rachel Vintage has been involved in helping with the layout in it, and I'm thrilled with it. It's a little bit wider than the narrow booklet form. Has a couple of columns on each page, a lot of nice color in there, and there are a lot of nice little touches. We've talked about it several times on our web teleconferences, and we've settled on a cover, and I'm excited to get it published and get it out and going. It'll go on the website first, and who knows, we may print it yet. We'll wait and see how funds go. But those types of things, obviously there's that formal part of it as well. You know, Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10 tells us we're to serve all humanity. Jesus Christ did that. You know, all the acts of service he did when he was here in the flesh, how many people had God's Holy Spirit that he did that for? How many were converted Christians? None of them. Right? Even the disciples weren't converted at that point. It was later that they received the Holy Spirit on the day of Pentecost. In Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10 says, therefore, as we, speaking of us as Christians, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all. Everyone, the whole world, everyone you come in contact with, treat them the right way. Treat them like Jesus Christ would. With the attitude of service and humility. Now, he goes on to say, especially those who are of the household of faith. Now, there is, in that sense, God gives us a priority. Take care of the church. Take care of the household of faith, your fellow Christians. Those who are members, begotten members of God's family. That's the closest family. But as you have opportunity, help everybody. Do good to everyone. That's a command. Now, we can argue over what it means to have opportunity, can't we? The opportunity has to hit me over the head before I know it's an opportunity. Or we can look for opportunities. You know, there are a lot of nuances. I understand how the mind works in this. You know, we could quibble about this. But the point is this. Don't turn your back on someone when you can do something helpful. When you can help them, don't turn your back on them. People get into all kinds of discussions of, you know, Red Cross and donations to community service, helping local schools, helping, they need help, teachers need help. You know, there are all kinds of ways that you can help in the community. You can't do it all. I understand that too. But as you have opportunity, as you have the ability, we should help. Christ was often moved with compassion, as I said. And I realize that when I talk about helping people, sometimes we have to be careful. There are a lot of people in our society today who are anxious to take advantage of anybody they can take advantage of. So there's some wisdom that's needed as well. But it is an obligation for us to serve the world as we have opportunity. What's the balance in it? Well, you got to work to find that balance, don't you? That's another one of the challenges of us as Christians, isn't it? Some people want to get into community activism and think that's Christianity. It's not, of and by itself. There's a lot more to it than just that. But what's the right balance? So that's where we have to do all of this, in the right balance. Passover is about self-examination, not examining what others are doing. But it is a part of our Christian responsibility to, as we have opportunity, as he says here, do good to all as you have opportunity, especially those who are of the household of faith. So I was struck by this particular approach, looking at the last night of Jesus Christ as a human being, and thinking about some of the teachings that he has given us, some of the things that are recorded here. This is Paul who made that statement about serving everyone, about serving all as we have opportunity. But it struck me, all of these things that I've mentioned, they're examples of that foot-washing attitude. That attitude of service, that attitude of humility. I don't mind getting down and helping, getting down on my knees and digging my hands in the dirt or my hands in the water to wash your feet. It doesn't bother me. I'm happy to do it. I'm happy to serve. I'm happy to humble myself. And the things I mentioned, that's not an exhaustive list. It's just a representative list. You can come up with lots of things, I'm sure, as examples of service and humility. Now, I sometimes wondered why Romans 12 was worded the way that it was, or the way that it is. Let's go to Romans 12. We'll conclude here. Romans chapter 12, verse 1. God inspired Paul to write this. I beseech you, therefore, brethren. This is not just a, well, you know, if you get around to it, maybe this is an okay thing to do. I beseech you. That's a powerful word. That's an action verb. I'm beseeching you to do this. It goes beyond just encourage. I'm beseeching you to do this. By the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. It's reasonable for God to expect this of us. It's reasonable for Paul to expect this of the Christians he wrote to, and for God to expect it of us today. Why is it reasonable? Well, it's reasonable because Jesus Christ set us that example, didn't he? He set us the perfect example of humility and service. Coming in the flesh was a service to all humanity. Washing the feet of the disciples was a service to all humanity. His whole life was a service, a living sacrifice. And if we're going to walk in the steps of Jesus Christ, guess what we should be doing as well? Should be thinking of others, should be living our lives as more of a living sacrifice for all mankind. The example of Jesus Christ and the foot-washing ceremony that he instituted for the New Testament Passover sets the example for us as Christians. Not just on that one night, but throughout the year. Let's set an example of service and humility to all.